And even today, we experience this question in the back of our minds. Is Jesus enough? Will the rope hold? Or will it give way? See, because all of us have had the experience of being disappointed, haven't we? Now, maybe you've gone on a journey and you had these expectations that when you arrived, this is what it was going to be like. This is what it was going to look like. It's going to be great. And you arrived and you were sorely disappointed at what you felt or at what you saw. See, all of us have had that experience of hoping to see something happen that doesn't materialize. And how horrible would it be if we spent this whole life following after Jesus and we stood before God one day and he said, oh, no. Jesus isn't enough. What a horrible thing that would be. So will the rope hold? This is the question that Paul is thinking about in Colossians 1. Will these guys, will we be disappointed if we give everything we have to Jesus Christ? If we place all of our eggs in that basket, will it let us down in the end? And so this is the question to which Paul turns today. Is our rope tied to the right person? Is Jesus really sufficient? Is he really the best one for us to place all of our hope in? How do we know? This is what Paul's going to talk about. In this great text, which again, many scholars feel this is an actual confessional statement or a hymn that the early church would have sang, something that they would have confessed together about who Jesus is. So it could be that Paul is borrowing the language from something that the church had grown to believe, even in those few years that the church had been around. But he begins by arguing that in all things, Jesus is preeminent. Now, preeminent is just a big way of saying that in all things, Jesus gets first place. He's on top of everything. There's no one above him. And this is what Paul's going to argue in verses 15 through 18. And he argues, firstly, that Jesus is first in everything because he is God in the flesh. See, the basis of Paul's argument that Jesus is first in everything is that he is first in everything because he is the fullness of God. Look at what he says in verse 15. He is the image. It's the word from which we get our word icon. He is the icon, the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. See, Jesus is the image of the invisible God. When Paul says he is the image of the invisible God, he means Jesus is not some shabby copy of the divine. He's not like a chip off of the divine, right? He's not like if you ask a child to sketch a picture of anything. If you ask a three-year-old to sketch it, it's not very precise, is it? If we're honest and we don't mind being cruel, it's probably pretty shabby in terms of the way it represents what you're asking them to draw. Jesus is not a shabby copy. He is the actual image. He is the image made visible of the invisible God. If we think about the way the author of the Hebrews, or the book of Hebrews says it, that Jesus, the Son, he is the radiance of the glory of God, the exact imprint of his nature. And he upholds the universe by the word of his power. He is the exact image. He is the mirrored representation of all that God is. So God's nature in Jesus, God's nature is completely revealed and manifest to us. This is what the Apostle John, how he says it. In John chapter 1, he says, no one has ever seen God, the only God who's at the Father's side. He has made him known. It's an incredible statement that no one has ever seen God, God the Father. But in God the Son, we see what God the Father is like. And so God the Son reveals to us, manifests to us, the nature of God. Back to Colossians, he is the image of the invisible God. And so when we see Jesus, we see God. We know what God is like when we consider what Jesus is like. Now, how do we know that God is love? We see Jesus. This is what Paul is arguing. You know, God is invisible. You know, God dwells, Paul says in 1 Timothy, he dwells in unapproachable light. And yet, when we gaze upon Jesus, we are able to see God clearly, who he is, because he is divine. So John Calvin said that in Christ, God shows us his righteousness, goodness, wisdom, power, in short, his entire self. This is Paul's argument. Jesus gets first place in everything because he is God. He's God. He expands this in down in verse 19 where he says, "For in him," that is in Jesus, "all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell." So in Jesus, the fullness, the totality, the full measure of what it means to be God, in Jesus, all of that dwelled fully. There is nothing that is true of God that is not true of Jesus, of God the Son. Over in chapter 2, verse 9, if you just turn the page over to chapter 2, verse 9, he says it again, and even more strongly in verse 9. "For in him," in Jesus, he says, "the whole fullness." It's a bit redundant, right? Fullness ought to be good enough, but he adds the whole fullness, or the full fullness. He says, "In him the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily." That everything that is true of God the Father, everything that is true of God the Son in terms of their divinity, everything that's true of God the Spirit in terms of their divinity is true of God the Son. The only difference is that in God the Son, he took on flesh. But he is the whole fullness of deity in bodily form. There's a word that's used in chapter 2, verse 9, and I don't throw Greek words up that often, but this is a great word. Theotetos is the word in chapter 2. Theotos, and if you have Philip, your King James, your authorized version, would say Godhead. And that's what this word is. It's the Godhead. And so it is the strongest word possible that Paul can use to stress the fact that Jesus Christ is everything that God is. He is God in the flesh. And he uses this word. He uses this word to say that Jesus doesn't just possess divine characteristics. He doesn't just possess some of the divine characteristics. He uses the word to say that in his fullness, Jesus is divine. So for the Apostle Paul, Jesus Christ takes first place because he is God in the flesh. And he is supreme over all things forever. His supremacy, his first place, isn't something that he's got to constantly battle for, right? He doesn't have to continue to work in order to maintain his number one spot. His supremacy, his preeminence is forever, because, again, he is God. So Paul says that he is first in relation to creation because as God, he created it. Created it. This is what he says in verse 16. "By him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible." All things were created through him and for him. So God the Son is the agent through which God creates everything. And so this is why Paul in verse 15 uses the word firstborn of all creation. He uses it to say that Jesus has preeminence because he existed before creation. So he is supreme in time. He existed even before there was anything. In fact, Paul says, he's the one that created it. So if he created it, he had to exist before it. See, he is preeminent. He gets first place. He is superior in time because he created everything. So Paul can say he was firstborn. But he's also superior in rank. So when Paul uses that word, firstborn, when he uses these prepositions where he says, by him all things are created, whether thrones, and he is before all things, he's using that to say that Jesus has preeminence because he existed before all things. Before anything was, he was there. And then if that's true, then he has first place. He is before in terms of rank, that he is higher above all that we see. He is the architect. He is the builder. He is the owner of all things. All things exist because of him. I remember when I was a kid, we would play a game called King of the Hill. Or maybe you, I don't know, sometimes it's King of the Castle or something like that. Where two people would stand up, or maybe more than two, would stand up on something and then would try to knock each other off. And whoever was the last man standing, that was the person who won. And so in this, if there is such a thing as a battle for supremacy in the universe, what Paul says here is quite simple. He says that Jesus is the king of the hill. Jesus is the last man standing. Jesus is the king of the castle. There's no one higher than him. He existed before everything. He is in rank above everything. He is the king of the hill. He says that in him all things hold together. That he is the not just the creator of all things, he's the sustainer of all things. You know, what keeps molecules together? What keeps electrons, you know, flying around the nucleus? What keeps the planets in orbit? It is God the Son who exercises his supremacy by sustaining all things. See, he is first. There's no one higher than him because he is God in the flesh. He is created in his power, and he sustains in his power. He is first in relation to creation. But then he shifts a little bit and he turns to the new creation. Look at what he says in verse 18. He's not just head of the created order. In verse 18, he is the head of the body, the church. He is the head. He is the preeminent one of those who are redeemed, of this new creation. Jesus is the head. He is the source. He is the authority over. He is the supreme one in relation to the church. And Paul uses this same word, firstborn, again. He says in verse 18, he is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead. Again, that in everything he might be preeminent. So Paul stresses again that Jesus is preeminent, that he has first place in the church, his body. And the reason he does is because he was the firstborn from the dead. So Jesus' resurrection from the dead is a foreshadowing of our resurrection from the dead. The resurrection power that God displayed in Jesus and raising him from the dead is the resurrection power that is ours, certainly one day in the future when we are raised from the dead. But even in the present, we can walk in the power of the resurrection as God is at work in us to make us new. See, Jesus is supreme. Jesus is number one. He has first place. Whether we're thinking about creation or whether we're thinking about the new creation, it doesn't matter. Jesus is preeminent. He has first place. He is, in verse 20, through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace through the blood of the cross. Paul makes the argument that everything exists for His glory. That in His, as the one who is supreme, that all things exist through Him, all things exist because of Him, they're sustained because of Him, and ultimately all things exist for His glory. And Paul says this in other places in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. Yet for us there's one God, the Father, from whom all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist. This is God's desire, is to glorify the Son. It's a familiar theme in the Apostle Paul. So what is the basis for our confidence? I mean, again, as we think about our hope for the future, what is the basis for us putting all of our eggs in the basket of Jesus, putting everything we have on the sufficiency of Christ? Paul continues on in verse 19 through 23. To make the point that hope of being with God is only found through Jesus. So Jesus' supremacy as God means that He alone can mediate the salvation that God offers. Only Jesus can save us. Only Jesus as God's man, the God-man, only Jesus can save us. Only Jesus can satisfy the righteous demands, the holy demands of God the Father. Only Jesus can, because He's God. Because He's God. See, because Christ possesses the absolute holiness of God, because Christ is the fullness of all of God's character, because Jesus is God in the flesh, He can satisfy the righteous demands of Jesus, of God, which we fall short of, don't we? No matter how hard we try, we